Welcome in to Bass Pro Shops Outdoor World, brought to you by Bass Pro Shops. If you love fishing, hunting, and the great outdoors and want to make it even better, you're in the right place. With host Rob Keck, your adventure starts right here.
Good morning and welcome, and thanks for tuning into Bass Pro Shops Outdoor World, brought to you by Bass Pro Shops, where truly your adventure starts right here. I'm Rob Keck, your host, and what an outstanding show we have for you today. And I'm really excited about it because one part of it's going to get maybe a bit emotional. But this week we're talking whitetails, food plots, preparation, and all the elements that make pursuing deer the crown jewel of hunting. And this and a whole lot more is coming right up with the host of Growing Deer TV, my good friend, Dr. Grant Woods. Well, before we meet today's guest, I want to tell you about the big event happening right now at Bass Pro Shops and Cabela's. It's the final weekend of the Fall Hunting Classic, where you're going to find the latest gear, the very best prices for all of your fall hunting adventures. And there's free seminars with the pros, free activities for the whole family, free games, prizes, food sampling, big bargains, and special pricing on all of your favorite hunting and outdoor gear. And yes, folks, let's bid summer goodbye today and tomorrow at the Fall Hunting Classic at all of our Bass Pro and Cabela's destination retail stores. Check us out online at BassProAndCabelas.com. And oh, by the way, for all of you NASCAR fans, this is a bye weekend on the Monster Energy Cup Series, but next weekend, join us as our number 78 Toyota Camry, driven by defending Cup champion Martin Truex, takes on the competition at historic Darlington Raceway next Sunday. Well, check us out again at BassPro.com. Well, this week's show, we're talking whitetail deer with what I consider to be an icon of the whitetail world, our good friend and member of the Bass Pro Shops Pro Hunting Team, Dr. Grant Woods. And this renowned whitetail authority, he's a native of the Ozark Mountains in southwestern Missouri. His passion for deer and deer hunting led him to a PhD in deer behavior and management. And during the past quarter century plus, he's been a wildlife biologist that has worked with deer from Canada to New Zealand. And he's the host of the wildly popular weekly show about deer hunting and management at Growing Deer TV. And he was recognized with the Al Brothers Professional Deer Manager of the Year Award, the Joe Hamilton Lifetime Achievement Award, and was selected by Outdoor Life magazine as one of 25 people who changed the face of hunting and fishing. Well, during this show, you will also experience how the gift of love saved Grant's life. Well, let's welcome fellow member of the Bass Pro Shops Redhead Pro Hunting Team, my good friend, Dr. Grant Woods. Grant, welcome back to Outdoor World.
Rob, always great to visit with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, I want to thank you for taking time. I know it's a busy time of year, and joining us here today and to share that passion and share the knowledge of deer and deer management and deer hunting. I don't know if there's anybody has any more common sense and good information about how we manage than you. You know, Grant, it's just great to have you back on this show. And speaking of shows, you did not get the opportunity to speak during the Fall Hunting Classic, which, of course, is going on this month because of needing some time to heal and recover from major surgery. And you shared with me a very special and a wonderful good news story that not only was the surgery successful, but it brought you and your daughter, Raleigh, even closer together. Would you mind sharing that story with our listeners?
You know, I'd really love to, because it's a great example of families, and I'm just blessed to be part of one. But 26 years ago, I had a kidney transplant, and as most folks know, gosh, I've been active and just had a great career after that transplant. But earlier this summer, the docs told me in my annual checkup that transplanted kidney was failing. Nobody's fault. It just had been filtering these nasty medicines I have to take every day, and those medicines had caused some harm to that kidney, caused some toxic stuff to go on. And so my wife was instantly tested, and she was not a match. And her 19-year-old daughter, Raleigh, and to tell you how much deer means to me, folks, Raleigh stands for Dweller by the Deer Meadow. It's Old English for Dweller by the Deer Meadow. Raleigh felt led to be tested, and I was really against it. I mean, it's just different for a parent to think about putting their child in harm's way. As parents, we protect our children. We don't send them into surgery. We protect them. But Raleigh felt very strongly that was something she should do and wanted to do. And so the Mayo Clinic agreed, and they did the testing, and Raleigh had a super healthy kidney. In fact, they said, Grant, she has a Formula One kidney, meaning everything just worked perfect. And so surgery was scheduled, and we had surgery on July 27th. And through Growing Deer and just the work I do, I want to be very candid. We had notes and letters and whatever from literally around the world of people said they were praying for us. And whether you believe in prayer or not, I do, we went into that surgery with zero anxiety. My daughter and I were laughing in pre-op, probably interrupted some other people, to be honest. I apologize if we did. We were laughing and, you know, comparing our hospital gowns and the socks and all that. And they come to take Raleigh into surgery, and right when they come to take her, she said, no, wait. And I thought, oh, my gosh, what's going on? And somehow she had snuck in a bag of kidney beans and said, here, Dad, pick the one you want. That's how I share that only because that's how little anxiety we had. We just had total peace. And Raleigh went in, and they removed the kidney out of Raleigh, and as they worked on that process, they took me into surgery and got me ready. And, you know, gosh, if you've been in a surgery room, there's lights and all kinds of stuff. It's kind of a spooky place, and I was totally at peace. And the doc said, I'm going to put a little oxygen mask on you, and I believed him. Well, the next thing I knew, I woke up in post-op. That oxygen mask had something besides oxygen in there. And I woke up in post-op, and as soon as I got my senses, my first prayer and question was, how's Raleigh? And said, she's doing great, and your kidney function is awesome. And as soon as they plugged it in, you started making urine, and it's really pure urine. It's just filtering perfectly. And I kind of dozed in and out trying to comprehend that. If you've ever been in anesthesia, you know what I'm talking about. And they took me up to the room. We had surgery about noon at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. And that night, just again, the power of prayer, at 9 o'clock that night, Raleigh just had surgery about noon. She came walking in my room, pulling her IV pole, wanting to check on me. The emotion of seeing the daughter that just saved your life is something I can't communicate very well. Because the doctor told me, folks, my kidney was failing so rapidly. And right now, this is really important to understand, there's about 100,000 people on the kidney waiting list. And many of them will die before a cadaver kidney is available for them. Raleigh truly gave me the gift of life. And you know what? You can do that for your family or even a friend. You don't have to be related. You can donate to anyone. And Raleigh's testimony reached out to so many people. A Growing Deer viewer from northern Minnesota, a lady, called us up right after surgery in her Texas or something and said, I'm thinking about donating to my dad. Could I come visit y'all because I'm kind of scared? And we had calls and emails from literally all over saying, hey, man, my brother needs a kidney, and I was thinking about donating, but I just don't know. And Raleigh was able to share with those people that she didn't have any anxiety. And most people don't know this, but kidney donors in America live an average of 5 years longer than healthy non-donors. I mean, you give up a part of your body, and you live 5 years longer on average. There's no guarantees. And here's the reason why. If you're a donor, you go through extensive pre-testing to make sure there's no cancers or diabetes or anything. You're super, super healthy. And then mentally, if you're willing to give up an organ to save someone's life, you've got a tremendous attitude about life. Stress and other things just are not going to impact you.
Let me interrupt you right there. We got to take this break, but I want to pick up right where you're at right now. Folks, we're going to return here in just a moment with a whole lot more coming right up. And I'm Rob Keck, your host here on Bass Pro Shops Outdoor World, only on Rural Radio, Sirius XM, Channel 147.
We'll be back in a moment to Bass Pro Shops Outdoor World, right here on Rural Radio on Sirius XM. Back to Bass Pro Shops Outdoor World, right here on Rural Radio on Sirius XM.
And welcome back to Bass Pro Shops Outdoor World here in Rural Radio. If you've just tuned in, we're visiting with the host of Growing Deer TV, but a proud father and one that really appreciates the gift of life, as he's telling us right now, Dr. Grant Woods. Grant, why don't you pick up where I cut you off right there? You were telling, you know, about your daughter, talking about Raleigh, picking up where, you know, you were talking that, you know, it's been found that those that donate a kidney live maybe a few years longer than the average. talk to us some more.
Healthy. They've been through all the screenings and pre-checks. No one's allowed to donate unless they're, you know, A, willing. They actually pass some psychological evaluations, make sure they're not being threatened into it or paid into it or anything like that. That's just not legal in America. And also that their health would permit them. Raleigh's 19 and can have, should have a family should she choose to. This is really amazing. The kidney in Raleigh, her kidney that's left, her residual kidney, will enlarge to compensate for loss, and it will adjust to my body size. And if you donate a kidney to an infant, an adult donates a kidney to an infant, no one really knows why this happens, but it shrinks to infant size and grows back with the infant as it goes through life. It's just truly a miracle. Truly, if you don't believe in miracles, go to a kidney transplant unit or a heart transplant unit, and you will believe in miracles. I trust you. So Raleigh, you know, had surgery at noon on July 27th, which is a Friday. She came walking in my room that night, pulling her IV pole and computers and everything, and checked on me, and we laughed and whatnot. Saturday, and I did not know this. I felt like a doofus, but she had taken an online, my daughter's in the Honors Business College at University of Arkansas, and she had an online calculus and Spanish class final. I knew she had the classes, but the finals due that weekend. So Saturday, she's hooked up to her IV poles and computers, and she's in there on her laptop taking the finals in calculus and Spanish and ends up making an A in both of them. And the doctors are just, you know, floored. I mean, A, Raleigh gives me the gift of life, and she's got a great attitude. Then she's taking a calculus final. Folks, I almost had to cheat to just make a C in calculus, let alone make an A. So anyway, it was just a great. But the biggest thing was Raleigh's testimony and how it reached so many people that were considering donating to someone. I'm more proud of that, and that my daughter's example is helping families around America. I am so proud of Raleigh at 19 for making that choice and leading others by example through her tremendous courage and her gift of life.
Since that transplant, tell me what that bond is like between you and Raleigh.
Well, you know, Raleigh and I were really close. Raleigh was raised in a hunting and fishing family, and we were really, really close. And, you know, it's often said if you hunt with your kids, you will not end up hunting for your kids later. And in our case, that was certainly true. And so Raleigh and I shared the same floor at the hospital, and we were walking together. They say walking's the best therapy. So, man, we were looping with our IV poles and going around and probably pestering other people and trying to be an example of, hey, get out of bed and start the recovery process. Even though it hurts a little bit, you get out. And then Raleigh got out. We had surgery on Friday. Raleigh was dismissed on Sunday, folks. I was dismissed on Monday, literally. A miracle, amazing. And Raleigh and I have always been close. As a matter of fact, I drove to the University of Arkansas yesterday, about 2 hours from where I live, Rob, and visited with Raleigh, brought her some stuff she'd forgot to take to college. She's doing great, but we have a hunt planned on Memorial Day. We're planning on, Labor Day. We're planning on going to Kentucky and hunting with my good friend, Mr. Hamby. They have an open archery season there for whitetails, and Raleigh and I love to hunt together. So Raleigh, my other daughter, Ray, and Tracy and I, my wife, are headed to Kentucky to go hunting together.
Well, what a story. What a bond. Gosh, I'll tell you, it just moves me to tears to hear this, but tears of joy that you've been able to do this. And I know the people listening have had to feel the very same way. God bless you both and your family for what you've done, the example you've set, and the blessing you've given to so many others. Well, look, we're going to talk some about food plots, too. And, before we talk about them, I just want to ask one other question.
Mm-hmm.
What advice would you give to dads who are taking their sons and daughters out hunting for the first time? You know, you mentioned this bond. What would you advise them?
You know, I think I had a great dad, and he was really patient with me as a youngster hunting. I remember the first deer hunt I ever went on was a muzzler hunt, and my job was to carry the ramrod, and of course, I was 6 years old, so the ramrod was my make-believe gun, and I spent all morning shooting at squirrels, quote-unquote, crows, and whatever, leaves or rocks or whatever, and Dad had no chance of seeing a deer because I was flagging that ramrod all over the place and rustling leaves, and I remembered how patient he was with me. So when Raleigh and Ray, my daughters, when it was time for them to go, and I didn't force it, I just would ask. We started with small game, squirrels and rabbits, or plinking with a BB gun was the first start, actually. We didn't go sit in a deer stand, you know, and you say, hey, now I don't want you to move for 3 hours to be quiet. That's not fun for anybody. It's not, you know, it's not going to be fun for a kid for sure. So we started in our with our goal of making fun. And I'll illustrate this one of my favorite hunts. It was Halloween. And, man, there was a cold front coming in, and it was right for deer hunting, folks. I mean, man, it was right. Any deer hunter would just, I got to get in a stand. And it was youth season in Missouri, and I had a food plot with some pretty good bucks coming in it, and I asked my youngest daughter, Ray, she was probably in maybe third grade at the time, hey, you want to go hunting this afternoon, or you want to go to Granny's and go trick-or-treat? No, Dad, I want to go hunting. Us. Now, are you saying that because of me, or, you? No, I really want to go. So we get down there, and boy, I mean, the wind is perfect, and it has got a little nip in the air, and it is right. And we get all set up. I got her set under a cedar tree in a little five-gallon bucket to put her little video Youth 223 on, and I mean, I just know tonight is the night. And about 2 minutes into it, she said, Dad, what time is it? Well, honey, we've got here. It's whatever it was, 4:30 or something. About, okay. And about a few minutes later, hey, Dad, what time is it? I said, well, it's 3 minutes later, honey. And third time, she goes, hey, Dad, what time is it? And I said, honey, would you really rather be trick-or-treating? She kind of whimpered a little bit and said, yeah, I guess I would. And you know what, folks? Even though, I mean, it was perfect out there, we packed that five-gallon bucket up and got the heck out of there because I wanted my daughter to associate hunting with fun, not yep. drudgery or not I had to.
Great
choices
example.
Choices like that, I think, are why my daughters now, I'm so proud of Raleigh, she will come home from college to go bow hunting. I mean, I have a daughter that will come home from college to go bow hunting with Dad. Who could be prouder of that?
What a gift.
I think it's because I never forced it. We always made it fun. When it wasn't fun, we come home, we quit, and we never focused on getting a deer. We focused on having a great time together.
Well, that three-letter word fun is so critical, and we've got to take our next break. Folks, when we return, we're going to continue our visit here with Grant Woods. This and a whole lot more coming right up. I'm Rob Keck, your host here on Bass Pro Shops Outdoor World, only on Rural Radio Sirius XM, Channel 147. Thanks for joining us, and we will be right back.
We'll be back in a moment to Bass Pro Shops Outdoor World, right here on Rural Radio on Sirius XM. Back to Bass Pro Shops Outdoor World, right here on Rural Radio on Sirius XM.
And we are back, and thanks for tuning in to Bass Pro Shops Outdoor World here in Rural Radio. And if you've just tuned in, we're privileged to have with us the TV host of Growing Deer TV, Dr. Grant Woods. Well, another season, another fall is upon us, and I got to ask you, any new gear, any new farming equipment that's going to be part of the preparation that you make this season?
You know, we are planting right now. I live in the Ozarks, just south of Springfield, Missouri, the headquarters of Bass Pro, and we've been in a drought all summer, but got some rain recently, so we're busy establishing our fall food plots, and we're using a no-till drill, a Genesis no-till drill, because when you plow, when you disc, or you disturb the soil in some way, it dries out or lets moisture escape. And we've been in such a drought, we want to conserve all the moisture we can. And, of course, farmers on the plains have been using no-till drills now for about 20 years, and it's really just totally changed from the Dust Bowl days, literally when the topsoil is blowing away or blowing on your neighbor's land, to keeping the soil on your place, and just as importantly, if not more importantly, keeping the water in your place. When you turn the soil or you expose it to air, of course, the moisture is going to evaporate. And Rob, I'd like to take that one a little bit further.
Sure.
When you use a no-till drill, maybe you just terminated the past crop or you're drilling right through the past crop, having that root structure and vegetation on top, of course, shades the soil. We don't think much about that, but it keeps it cooler. And some really cutting-edge recent research has just changed my whole outlook on this. But if you keep the surface of the soil about 70 to 75 degrees, 100% of the moisture in there is available for plants.
Mm-hmm.
If it gets up in the 80s or 90s, about 30% will evaporate, literally. So, you know, it has to rain a third more just to be the same. And if you get to 100 degrees, less than 50% of the moisture is available for plants. The rest will evaporate. And you say, well, Grant, gosh, it's got to be pretty hot to get the soil up to 100 degrees. Well, I start thinking about that after this research is published, and I ain't buying real cheap anymore, an infrared heat gun. You point it at whatever, a bush, a ground, a car, and it tells you the heat. It's really cool. It's kind of a fun toy, actually. So I went out in my food plots one day, and it's about 88 degrees. It's about 9 in the morning. And so I was thinking, well, the soil will be about maybe 75 or 80 because it cooled all night. Rob, where there was bare soil, where the tractor had kind of pushed the mulch away, so to speak, it was 130 degrees. We actually videoed this, folks. You can see it.
You're
130
kidding.
Degrees. And the reason is, you know, like if you put your hand on a black car surface, even though it's only 90 degrees outside, it might burn your hand. Because that sun's energy is being captured on that dark surface. Well, it's the same as soil. And so on these drought years, the reason we're able to grow a pretty good crop in a drought year is we work to always keep our soil covered with mulch. We're just drilling right through the last crop and planting a new crop, and that's reflecting the heat before it gets to the soil. And there's guys out in the plains that get 10 or 12 inches of rain a year and are growing 200 bushel corn because they've learned it's cheaper to conserve the soil than irrigate. Mm-hmm. Well, it's never practical to irrigate a food plot, so conserving soil moisture has become a key to my food plot success.
Wow. Well, with it being food plot time and you're getting those plots ready right now, talk to us about the fall foods themselves.
Yeah, you know, fall foods need to have a couple of objectives. They didn't want to attract deer. I want to see deer. My daughters want to see deer, so I want to plant something that's going to be attractive for deer to come eat. Now, you know, here's a reality. We all know this if you've been hunting a while. When the white oak acorns hit the ground, or Rob, down where you live, those big swamp chestnut acorns hit the ground, deer are going to abandon the food plot. They're going to those acorns are like candy. But I scout the acorns, and that just gives you a couple-week break for your food plots to grow some more tonnage out there, because the acorns are going to get gone at some time.
Sure.
But I want a food plot that's going to attract deer. Then B, I want a food plot that's going to be nutritious for the deer varieties in the food plot. You know, I want to grow some bigger deer. I'm not a giant trophy hunter. I mean, I like big antlers when I see them. But, man, my daughters, they're going to shoot something steps out there. I'm going to be happy for them. I'm going to congratulate them and put some venison in the freezer. So I want something that's going to be healthy for the deer. And that was kind of the first 20 years of my career was those two objectives. But as I've matured and, I live in these rocky, poor soil Ozark Mountains, I've learned there are some plants that actually improve the soil. And we've all probably heard about legumes, clovers, soybeans that take nitrogen out of the air and pump it in the soil. That's a great thing. But is there more? Well, I've learned in the last few years through some great research, there's a lot more. Different plants are really good at capturing different nutrients deep in the soil profile that maybe other plants can't reach. Here's a kind of a surprise and something I've started blending with soybeans sometimes. I now learn that sunflowers, they have a massive root system. They're very drought resistant. You see them planted out in Kansas and the plains where it's pretty dry out there because they have a really deep root system that will get down to moisture, and they do a fabulous job of capturing nutrients deep in the soil and bringing them up to the surface. So I've been working with some seed folks, and we're putting about 10% of a normal sunflower blend in with our soybeans. The field looks kind of odd. You've got tall sunflowers sticking up above your soybeans every 10 feet or so out there. And those roots are bringing up huge amounts of nutrients. And then through natural fungi, it's kind of a funny word, right? Fungi in the soil, if you don't disc, if you only no-till drill, this fungi will make a fish net networked all through the soil, and literally it had transferred nutrients from one plant to another. Think of fungus. We kind of think of fungus as bad, like, ooh, you got a fungus, or that's bad. But
sure,
fungus can be extremely beneficial in transferring nutrients from one plant to the other. And this is like cutting edge research. And I was just fortunate enough to get involved in it and transfer it from the professional ag world to the food plot world. So I'm throwing a few soybeans in. Here's another cool plant, buckwheat. Buckwheat is really good at grabbing phosphorus. Phosphorus is one of the most important elements for antler growth and fawn development. And you throw about 10% phosphorus in with your soybeans. Man, all of a sudden those soybeans can grab more phosphorus. And here's the thing, Rob. I've been working on this for about 5 years now, and you know how poor the soil is where I live. I haven't added any fertilizer, no fertilizer, folks. Think of the cost savings in 5 years now. And I'm growing great deer and great food plots. And I teamed up with a couple folks that are brilliant, way more brilliant than me, at Eagle Seed. They have PhDs in soybean genetics, and they've helped me figure out what blends and what ratios, not too much, not too little, to put together in these seed blends to achieve these results. So not spending any money on fertilizer, very little money, if any, on herbicide, because if you grow a really good crop, there's no weeds competing with it. And if you don't diss the soil, you're not exposing weed seeds where they're germinate. So we're using way less herbicide, which I'm not anti-herbicide, but let's face it, why use it if you don't need it? Why go to that expense? Why put it on the soil?
And it is expensive. Well, look, we got to take another break here, and we got a lot more to talk about. And, folks, we're talking about food plotting and whitetail strategies. One of the icons and true professionals of the whitetail world, Dr. Grant Woods. This and a whole lot more coming right up, and I'm Rob Keck. And you're listening to Bass Pro Shops Outdoor World, only on Rural Radio Sirius XM, Channel 147, and we will be right back.
We'll be back in a moment to Bass Pro Shops Outdoor World, right here on Rural Radio on Sirius XM. Back to Bass Pro Shops Outdoor World, right here on Rural Radio on Sirius XM.
And welcome back to the second half hour of Bass Pro Shops Outdoor World here in Rural Radio. And we are privileged today to have the host of Growing Deer TV and a Redhead Pro Hunting Team member, my good friend, Dr. Grant Woods. Well, Grant, you're talking about planting techniques, and you've mentioned one that I want you to elaborate on. The buffalo system. Tell our listeners about that.
Yeah, Rob, we were just talking about using less fertilizer and herbicide and stuff and different plant varieties, and that got me thinking about natural processes. And I was thinking, okay, now where's the best soil in America? Where's the best soil on the planet? And, of course, the Great Plains, the prairie, deep, deep black soils. I'm like, well, how did that come to be? And I started studying and reading and researching, and if you think about it, on the prairies, the Great Prairies, they think about 60 million buffalo, and predators and wildfire and lack of food would keep them moving all the time. And there's a variety of plants. So here's some keys. There's a variety of plants growing on native prairie, not just a monoculture like all beans or all corn, a variety of plants. Mm-hmm. So I got an ambulance passing by. There's a variety of plants growing, and those different plants, it turns out, are capturing different nutrients out of deep in the soil profile, bringing them to the surface, and either a buffalo or an elk or deer ate them and defecated them out, or they trampled them to the ground right on top of the soil surface. There was no plowing going on, and new plants come up. And once I thought about that process, all the lights went on at once. So I'm thinking, the best soil in the world was built without plowing or disking, and it's been going downhill in quality ever since we started plowing. From erosion, from nutrients leaching deeper in the soil profile, from all these things. So, all right, we never plowed. We had the best soil, and there was always a variety of plants, not a monoculture. Why do we plant a monoculture? Well, we plant a monoculture so the combine will only get one type of seed into sale. Well, my combine's a deer, and it doesn't care. It just wants good quality plants. So we can plant a variety, 5, 6, 7, 8 different varieties at a time, and that's actually better for the deer because men are growing antlers. They want to eat on something that's heavy in phosphorus and calcium, or maybe they're they need a lot of energy, so they want something that's got some seeds on it, so it's got some oil in it for high energy content. And when I adapted that mindset about 5 years ago, I totally started changing my food plot program. And after 20 years of being in the food plot business, I'm producing better food plots now than I ever have for way less money. My biggest expense, wear and tear on the tractor, all that stuff. Let's just assume you got to have a tractor anyway, or a broadcast seed, or however you're planting your plots. So I do all my plots by hand, but anyway, let's just figure that's even. My biggest expense now is seed, not lime, not fertilizer, not herbicide, no insecticide, just seed. And what I've learned, there's so many things. Gosh, I get so excited about this. When you've got a variety of plants going, there's different root structures. Some deep, some broad, some shallow. They're pulling all these different nutrients up, and whatever the deer don't eat, I just let that decay on top of the soil, and it's like the perfect slow-release fertilizer. And that mulch also, we talked about this earlier, is covering the soil to keep the soil temperature down so it won't get so hot. We don't evaporate moisture. Now, let's take this another level. You know, I like to fish. I'm not a good fisherman. I like to go bluegill fishing, catfishing, whatever. And when we first bought the place here near Branson, Missouri, I couldn't find enough earthworms to take my daughters fishing. And this spring, in one shovelful, I mean, literally, this is on video, folks. You can go watch it. One shovel out of one of our little food plots, I counted 36, three dozen earthworms in one shovel. And I found out when you keep that mulch layer on the ground, well, that's perfect earthworm food. You think about where you might go dig worms, a leaf pile, compost pile, something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's the mulch layer on top of my ground, and I started researching earthworms. And it turns out if you've got a healthy population of earthworms, literally, this number is so large, some people may not believe it, but they can produce up to 1 million pounds of soil per acre per year. Now, 1 million pounds of soil, folks, is not much more than a sheet of paper thick over a whole acre. So put it in perspective. You're not building inches a year or something. But you're adding a little bit of super high-quality soil every year just by making good habitat for earthworms. And then, you know, their excrement, of course, is a little pellet-type thing, and it's super high-quality fertilizer. It sells for a huge amount at stores, all the organic stores and everything.
Right.
But if you've got 1 million earthworms per acre in your food plot, you don't need to fertilize anything. Man, they're doing their job 24/7. And in addition to making the world's best fertilizer, it's called vermiculture. The world's best fertilizer, by all acclaims, worm poop is the best fertilizer. In addition to doing that for you, they're aerating the soil, right? They're making the perfect holes, just like God planned, all through the soil and everything. And when it rains, water goes in instead of running over the top because the worms got all these little channels in there. And the lubricant on the worm, you know, when you pick up a fishing worm, they're kind of slimy.
Turns out
that lubricant is really high-quality stuff for plants, too. So when they slide by a root, the root's going, oh, man, is that good. I mean, it's just, once I got into the natural systems, and listen, folks, I'm not anti-herbicide or anti-fertilizer. I do what it takes to grow a good deer. But if I can do it for less money and use natural systems and less pollution, make the environment better, absolutely I want to do that. So now my food plot system's real simple. In the spring, you know, I've got whatever's left from the fall crop, and there's always very few weeds in that fall crop. They don't grow near as much in the fall as they do in the spring. So I got basically a weed-free crop coming into the early spring, late winter, early spring. Now I take a no-till drill. You can rent them. If you don't own one, a lot of people get two or three buddies together and buy one because you don't need one by yourself, but get two or three buddies. Or almost every county in America, the NRC office, the Natural Resource Service office, rents no-till drills.
They do.
It's a huge, great thing that we can have.
And we've got them right here.
I drill right through the standing crop. I don't spray it. I don't bush hog it. It's still standing. And that makes the perfect greenhouse for my summer crop coming up. And then when that summer crop comes up and gets about 2 inches tall, this sounds crazy. Let's go back to the Great Prairie. Remember, buffaloes were terminating the crop out there? Well, I've kind of helped design a little crimper. I don't sell any stuff, folks. I'm not trying to sell anything. I just help other companies do stuff. And it's like a roller, except it's got blades on it. And the reason it's got blades, it's not cutting the vegetation, but it's crimping it. Because if you mow your yard, if you cut it, it just grows back, right? Weeds will grow back. But if you crimp it, you break the circulatory system every 6 or 8 inches, it terminates it. So I let the new crop, usually soybeans and sunflowers and buckwheat or whatever for me, get about 2 inches tall. Then I crimp over the top of it. It doesn't hurt those young pliable plants, but it kills any weeds that are there in my fall crop and makes a perfect mulch layer. And the new plants grow right up through it, and I've never plowed, I never disc. I drill, and I crimp, and I'm done for the summer. A huge
Look,
cost savings.
What common sense, what good sense, and what a plan it is. Look, we got to take another break. Folks, we return, going to continue our conversation here on food plotting with Dr. Grant Woods right here in Bass Pro Shops Outdoor World, exclusive on Rural Radio Sirius XM, Channel 147. It's Rob Keck, and we will be right back.
We'll be back in a moment to Bass Pro Shops Outdoor World, right here on Rural Radio on Sirius XM. back to Bass Pro Shops Outdoor World, right here on Rural Radio on Sirius XM.
And we are back, and thanks for tuning into Bass Pro Shops Outdoor World here in Rural Radio. And if you've just tuned in, we're privileged to have with us the TV host of Growing Deer TV, Dr. Grant Woods. You know, Grant, okay, I'm sitting here in South Carolina, and I've got to ask you the question, will this process work on coastal, plain, and Piedmont soils here in the South?
Yeah, you know, it probably works better to pour the soil, the more impact it will have. And I've got a bunch of buddies. You know, Rob, I used to live in Abbeville County, South Carolina, not far from you there.
Oh, I know it, just up the road.
Yeah, hard red clay, and then I had a bunch of buddies down in the coastal plain where it's just deep sand. You're like, nothing grows in this deep sand. And I've got some buddies now that, you know, just friends of mine that have implemented what we call the Buffalo System. And after 3 or 4 years, Rob, literally they're building black organic matter because those decaying crops are becoming rich black organic matter right on top of the sand. And it's holding more moisture because moisture and nutrients, I mean, they just go through sand, right? They end up in China or wherever they end up down there. Mm-hmm. And we're building black organic matter and growing bigger deer on sandy soils.
Well, let me ask you this, then. Are you going to pull soil samples based on what you've just shared with us? Is that important?
I do, but I don't. I do because of, I'm a researcher, you know, by training, and I want to know, is this improving the soil or whatever? But I don't use them like I used to. I now use them for research or documenting what's going on because I'm not buying fertilizer anymore.
Yeah. Well, look, you know, I live here on that dividing line between the Piedmont and the coastal plain, and, you know, we've got a variety of soil types. In fact, Some have said we've got 7 different soil types right here, from red clay to sandy loam to just pure sand. And, You know, that mixture, you know, I could find that in 1 half-acre plot.
Yeah.
I mean, I've got some that you'll see that mixture, especially when you turn the ground, you see the colors change and the texture of the soil. With that said, you know, how do you decide just – you know, if you're going to pull a soil sample, then how would you do that?
You know, you just got to take an average, and a lot of guys have that. You know, they're on the edge of an old logging deck, and then it drops off to better soil or whatever. And you got to take an average and then err on the high side of that average because you don't want to cheat the poor soils in that plot, and you don't want to put too much on the really rich soil. So you take an average and then kind of, you know, cheat on the high side of that average. So anytime you're taking soil samples, you want a really good representation of the whole plot, not just one corner. I always joke, you know, maybe a buffalo died in that one spot. So I kind of walk over the whole plot and take samples everywhere.
Well, give us a sample here, the varieties of seeds that you're planting with this system of food plotting.
Yeah.
Especially, so you know, when you look, you know, here in South Carolina, Low Country opens August 15th, runs to January 1st, and, you know, you've got plantings that you could time for early, some for mid to late season to hunt over, and, of course, some we want to have out there beneficial to deer nutrition throughout the year. So give us your preferences on what you'd plant to target each one of those seasons.
That's a great point, Rob, and I think everyone needs to have what I call time-release plots. I want something that attracts deer early season. And that could be a young clover coming up, or a radish deer really like radishes early on. And I want something mid-season, and that would be your wheats and cereal rye. I never plant rye grass, but cereal rye is really good for that. And then I want something late season, and that may be more of your turnip or harder type of brassicas, something that doesn't really become palatable late season. So there's no one plant I'm aware of that's perfect for early, mid, and late season.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where if you plant a blend, you can take advantage of that time-release system. So here at my place, I'm so steep and rocky, I'm limited on food plot acres per the number of deer I have, so I want the maximum tonnage. So I'm usually planting 7, 8, 9 different varieties in a blend for that early, mid, and late season. And one of those is always a radish, and the radishes start off strong, they jump out of the ground. But I got to tell you, by mid-October, I can't even find a radish in the plot because the deer have ate them all up. and that's okay because I plant more seed than most guys recommend. Seed's the cheapest thing you can do out of everything else we're talking about here.
Sure is.
And so knowing that the radishes are going to get gone, I'm going to plant more seeds, more pounds per acre, if you will, of the later season stuff because they're just filling those gaps where the radishes were. So if you really think it through, boy, you can do so much more than just plant, boy, I'm going to plant, you know, 70 pounds of wheat per acre. That doesn't fill all the gaps in.
Sure.
By using a blend, you can fill all the gaps in and improve the soil at the same time.
We just got to have about a minute and a half here in this segment, but where can one find a good guide that tells you about the timing on when to plant different seeds in each region of the country?
No matter where you are, you either want to A, plant before deer season, or B, 45 to 60 days before the first frost. Most fall varieties are designed to be planted about 45 to 60 days before the first frost, because that ties back into day length. Plants are very much oriented towards the amount of sunshine per day. So don't worry about what it says in the guide, because everywhere is different and frost dates are different, and those are just very generic guidelines. But you may know, well, I got a valley here and it always frosts a month earlier than it does my neighbor's place because he's on the hilltop. Mm-hmm. So learn your property and plant about 45 to 60 days before the first average frost date in your area.
Well, look, you and I both hunt more than whitetails. Turkeys probably come in there second. And, of course,
sure.
Spring turkey season doesn't compete with fall deer hunting. So if you had one seed to plant for both deer and turkey, what would it be?
I'm going to cheat and say two seeds. I would plant crimson clover. Turkeys love crimson when it's coming up in the spring. I mean, love it. And cereal rye. That will get you through the late winter for deer, and the turkeys will be right in there getting the clover out of it. So if you just plant that real simple blend, which is really inexpensive and easy to plant, cereal rye and crimson clover, you'd cover both those bases.
All right. We got to stop right there, take the final break of our show, and we return. We're going to discuss some closing thoughts on the world of whitetails, and you're listening to Bass Pro Shops Outdoor World, only on Rural Radio Sirius XM, Channel 147. It's Rob Keck, and we will be right back.
We'll be back in a moment to Bass Pro Shops Outdoor World, right here on Rural Radio on Sirius XM. Back to Bass Pro Shops Outdoor World, right here on Rural Radio on Sirius XM.
And welcome back to our final segment of Bass Pro Shops Outdoor World here in Rural Radio. We've been having a fun and certainly an educational visit with host of Growing Deer TV, Redhead Pro Hunter, my good friend Grant Woods. Well, gosh, Grant, we've talked an awful lot about what to put in the ground to try to attract deer and aid to the nutrition. Talk to us about how do you set stands up then on these food plots? How do you come to determine just where your best location might happen to be?
Yeah, guys, I think I mentioned earlier, my family and I hope to get to go hunting here in just about a week and a half in Kentucky. Their season opens September 1st, so we're right in that process right now. And, I'm like everyone else. I use a lot of choke cameras, and right now, before the acorns hit the ground, those deer are pouring into food plots. So put a choke camera up and kind of get an idea of what corner they're coming out of or what time they're getting there. And then on that information, you can kind of plan your route to A, to approach, hunt, and exit the stand without alerting deer. That's my number one thing. I want to be able to get to my stand, hunt, and leave. People forget leaving without alerting deer. So if I don't tag that day, or someone else could hunt it the next day or whatever. And then I usually hunt afternoons primarily in the early season, because it's really tough to get in without alerting deer in the morning. They're moving, you're moving, just a bad time. But if you can go in the afternoon when they're still in their bed, and then let the deer come to you, your success rates are usually much higher. So afternoon hunts are my preference in the early season. And then, this seems odd, but I kind of like my stand on the east side of the food plot. Most of our winds are out of north, south, or west in most areas. And then also, if you notice, deer usually come in these warmer early fall days. They come to the west side of the plot a lot of times because it's in the shade the quickest in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. And I really want my stand been on the plot size and orientation on the other side so I can see the deer coming, and they're not coming out right below me and maybe getting my wind or something. So most of my stands in early season are going to be on the east side of a plot for those reasons.
Well, let me ask you this. You mentioned a very critical factor, and that's wind. How do you check before you go to that stand whether you should actually go there or not, simply because of alerting that deer that you may never see, but he certainly picks up your scent?
Yeah, that's a critical part of hunting, Rob, and I know you're a master at that. I like to scout ahead of time because, food plots, they're rarely out in the middle of a prairie, right? They're in the timber. And so the weatherman, you look at the weatherman, or you look at your phone app, and he says, boy, the wind's out of the north today. But because of the weighted timber lays, and then all of a sudden you've got an opening, just like an eddy behind a rock in a stream, the wind may swirl in that food plot. And the north wind may be what hits the south timber and swings back around 45 degrees or something. So only the best way to do that is have experience, go out a few days for season and say, okay, today the wind's out of north, but in this particular plot it's really more of a northwest wind or a northeast wind or whatever. And that's really how I fine-tune my stand placement, based on knowledge of that plot and how the wind behaves in that particular opening in the forest.
Any preference on the kind of stand that you hunt? Ladders, lock-on,
I use
box,
lock-ons, but as I get older, those ladder stands are getting a little bit more handy, I'll tell you the truth.
Has for me, too.
Yeah, you can get up them quiet. They're a little safer. My kids like them. So, you know, I'm not picky, just something safe. I want everyone out there to absolutely be tethered into that tree or that stand. Don't be climbing free. You don't falls. There's just no reason for a hunter to have a horrible fall. Be tied in. Safety harnesses and safe lines are a must for hunting off the ground.
Well, it is. And next month is Tree Stand Safety Month, and we're going to be talking about that during the month of September. Just very quickly, why don't you tell our listeners where they can find a whole lot more about what you are talking about on Growing Deer TV. How can they find that show?
Yeah, if you want to learn about the buffalo system or our hunting techniques, our food plot techniques, simply go to growingdeer.tv or growingdeer.com, either one. We make a new show every week, 52 weeks a year. Been doing it almost 10 years now, so there's a lot of information out there.
When does it air?
You know, it's available 24/7, but we put a new show up every Monday. Every Monday we put a new show up, and you can go to that website, or you can watch it on your Apple app or Roku or Android Fire or any of those things. Any of the TV apps, you can watch it on the big screen if you want.
Grant, 10 seconds. Final thought.
You know, enjoy every day, folks. I just had a transplant. Enjoy every single day.
There you go. Grant, well said. Thanks for being with us today. Congratulations on all the achievements that you've given, not to just hunters, but to the quality of life of so many people in this great land of ours and the future of hunting. Folks, that's going to wrap it up here in Bass Pro Shops Outdoor World. Back next week, same time, 10 Eastern, 9 Central, here in Rural Radio Sirius XM Channel 147 with another show you won't want to miss. And until then, I'm Rob Keck. On behalf of Bass Pro Shops, where your adventure always starts right here. Thanks for answering the call. That call to conservation and preserving our rich hunting, fishing, and trapping heritage. See you next week.
This has been Bass Pro Shops Outdoor World, talking all things outdoors, brought to you by Bass Pro Shops, your outdoor leader. Join us next Saturday and every Saturday for more special guests and unique locations, right here on Rural Radio, the Agribusiness and Western Lifestyle Channel.